On this episode...
The Reagan Library had just found out that they were getting one of the retired airplanes. And they had no idea what to do with it. So they went around to all the, especially aircraft museums in Southern California, trying to get an idea of what do we do with this airplane. So they came to the Palm Springs Air Museum, and they saw what I had done.
From the coveted corner booth in a little bar in the center of the Coachella Valley universe, welcome to another Big Conversation with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence. Gentlemen.
Welcome to this edition of Big Conversations Little Bar. We are really excited to be here once again at the center of the Coachella Valley Universe, Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California. My name is Patrick Evans. I am your host along with Randy Florence.
That's my name.
Yes, it is. Welcome, Randy.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Today, we are really excited, and I wish, you know, a lot of podcasts have video. We don't. But this would be one of those that would
be great. We've actually, it's been requested that we not have video.
Yes, it has. Well, Randy, you'd have to actually get dressed to come in and do this if we had video.
I'm not sure you'd keep showing up.
We have Stan Stokes, world-renowned artist. His art encompasses so much aviation art.
Yeah.
And I was just asking him, and he's going to tell us the story in a minute, but he met dozens of the Tuskegee Airmen and did portraits for them. You have paintings in the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush presidential libraries that were commissioned. You have a beautiful mural at the Palm Springs Air Museum.
Yeah, actually several.
Many pieces there.
Yeah.
The big mural. And so, Stan, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. It's kind of a glorious day here in Palm Desert.
It is. And we always like to thank Patrick, the weather person for KESQ, for bringing in the good weather.
Well, he brought us 81 degrees and relatively clear.
I accept no thanks for the good weather, because then I'd have to accept responsibility for the bad weather.
So. Well, if we were Canadian, we'd all be out by the pool.
Well, this is true. Yes. Yes, we would. But we would be wearing sandals with socks, so that's what the Canadians do. Do we have any listeners in Canada, John? No. Okay, so we're good. I can make all those decisions. You have, for 50-plus years, been a working artist in high demand.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously local. You have a lot of work hanging at the Palm Springs Air Museum.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start here. How did you get it? Because a lot of your artwork is very niche artwork.
Yes, it is.
The aviation artwork in particular.
Yeah.
How did you get into this line of art?
As a kid, I was an airplane nut, building all the model airplanes, building flying airplanes. And my dad would take me around to the different airports in Southern California every chance we had. And I grew up in Glendora. From there, it was a real easy drive over to Brackett Field, a little bit further to Cable Airport, El Monte in the other direction. And then if we really wanted to get adventuresome, go over to Ontario and Flybob in Rubidoux, March Air Force Base, Norton Air Force Base, all those. I frequented all of them.
And when you were growing up, that was a time where, and there's still a bit of the aviation industry here, but there was a lot of it.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of it here, and Lockheed had a facility at Ontario, and I can remember being there and watching them test fly a Lockheed Constellation, a Navy one, so a C-121. And just all of those things that we don't get to see anymore. But the neat thing was we were decades away from 9/11, and you could generally hang out at the airport. Like a bracket, we could go and walk amongst the airplanes, touch airplanes. And to a kid, that really is something, to be able to touch the airplanes. And for quite a while at Bracket, there were two derelict P-38 Lightnings and a T-28 and a B-25. And they were there for years. And keeping it brief, a lot of years later, I'd gotten to know Bob Pond, who was the genesis of the whole Palm Springs Air Museum.
A lot of the initial aircraft there were.
Yeah, and I had known Steve Hinton and Ed Maloney over at Chino for a long time. They had just restored P-38 for Bob Pond. Steve had flown it to Minneapolis, where Bob's original museum was. on spur of the moment, they had me paint some nose art on it, which I shouldn't have been able to do it that fast, but I did because it was going to Oshkosh the next morning. So
and the paint dried.
Yes, yeah, kind of. Steve Hinton was pre-flight in the airplane, and he was asking me to paint around all of the fuel caps, the fuel capacity there. So we're chit-chatting, talking, and everything. And I said, Steve, whatever happened to the two P-38s that were bracket field? And he said, well, you're painting on one of them.
Wow, was the plane you saw growing up as a kid.
Yeah, and that's the one that's over at Planes of Fame now that still flies. So I have known that P-38 since 1960.
Wow.
And some of these airplanes I go way, 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 way back with. And you get it in your blood, and you get different aspects of aviation in your blood. When I was 7, 8 years old, I was on Big Bear Lake with my dad and a friend of his with the friend's outboard motorboat, and we were fishing early in the morning. And two F-104s came in real low right over Big Bear Lake and went right over our heads. And then up and over the dam and heading down towards Norton and San Bernardino. But to an 8-year-old kid, that's like taking liquefied F-104 and injecting it right into your DNA. And from that point on, going, oh, F-104s. It was all of those things that made it to where by the time I was 14, I was riding my bike over to Brackett Airport and, you know, just indulging in aircraft as often as I could.
When did the love for aircraft transition to a love of painting them? When did you...
Well, that was the other thing I was doing as a kid, is doing drawing. Now, I never had any paints as a kid, but I was drawing a lot. And my first year of college was just junior college, Citrus Junior College, halfway between Glendora and Azusa, and I had two art classes. And September, when the classes started, I was introduced to my first actual set of paints. And about 2 weeks into it, I was thinking, I like this. And I never stopped. But at the same time, I started taking flying lessons when I was 14. And for a while there, I didn't have the money to finish it up. But in 1971, I got my pilot's license. But at the same time, I was painting full-time. I went to Art Center College of Design after Citrus. And that's when it was in its original location in downtown L.A. It's just off the Arroyo in Pasadena now.
Yeah, okay.
And they wanted to teach you how to design cars and toasters and everything in between. And I wanted to do fine art painting. So before I graduated, I left, much to my parents' disappointment and everything. Years later, my mom had a gallery in Carmel featuring my artwork, so it all worked out.
So you turned their disappointment into pride and joy.
Yeah.
And but, maybe some money.
I suspect, yes.
In those early days, you know, when I had just gotten my pilot's license, and I was a starving artist, I have no idea how I did this, but I managed to buy an airplane.
Good heavens.
It was a little airplane.
What was the plane that you bought?
It was the Citabria, the 7KCAB Citabria, aerobatic airplane. And I
had bought, when people would see in air shows.
Well, this is a learn how to do that. This isn't so much an air show airplane.
This is learning
how to do loops and rolls and hammerheads and stuff. Without
and you
flying.
Actually wanted to do those things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I bought the airplane off a movie production company that had just done the movie The Other Side of the Mountain about the skier Jill Kinmont.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you see that movie, that's my airplane.
That's your airplane.
The Beau Bridges is supposed to be flying. He's supposed to crash and get killed in it. I had it, so it didn't crash.
You still have it?
No.
No.
But when I sold it, it had gone up in value enough that all my flying in it was for free. And how often in the life does something like that happen?
That's pretty amazing. Congratulations. That's excellent.
Now, when you started painting, were planes the first thing?
My very first painting, and I actually sold it, was a surfer on a big wave. And I had no idea that anybody would want paintings of airplanes. So I didn't do that for a long time. I got to where I was getting pretty well known for doing little intimate scenes of creeks with ferns and multicolored leaves and stuff.
And you were able to make a living at that point doing it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was beginning to happen and everything.
Yeah.
But I also had the airplanes. And in 1977, I think it was, I was a member of the Experimental Aircraft Association, Oshkosh, the big air show at Oshkosh. They had an art show or art competition every year. And I had an airplane that was half-built, a Steen Skybolt, which was an open cockpit biplane that could do all the aerobatics. It could make you really, really sick. And I did a painting of that, even though the airplane still had half of its way to go on being built, and entered it in the art competition. That was my first airplane painting. And I came in second place.
Wow.
And I thought, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And over the next year, I started getting commissions, and I would say maybe 2 years into it, most of what I was doing was aviation.
And on a lot of commissions?
Yeah.
A lot of people who I know, you know, everybody I've ever known that has had a boat or a yacht always has a portrait of their.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I imagine people with planes are kind of the same way.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they have any money left. an airplane, strangely enough, you know, with the boats, the second best day is when you buy it, and the first best day is when you sell it. Usually people with airplanes hang on to them. And, I mean, I know guys that have had the same airplane for 40, 50 years. And sometimes it's airplanes that they've had that long. They don't get rid of them. And they love them. And if they could take them home at night, they would.
How often do you fly?
I don't fly that often anymore because I'm so busy. I've got a backlog of commissions that to keep customers happy, I have to get things done. And I've got five really big ones to do right now.
Anything you can talk about?
Yeah. For years, they have been completely renovating little old Flaybob Airport in Roubidoux.
Yeah.
It's owned by the Tom Wathen.
And I want to talk about this.
Yeah,
this is just a fascinating organization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is the fifth oldest airport, if I remember right, in California. And they've worked very hard to keep that old California feel about it. The runway is just a little bit less than 3,000 feet long. Because the second you hit 3,000 feet on the length of a runway, all the government agencies want to come in and make sure you're doing everything right. If you keep it below that, you're
2950.
Yeah, you're kind of underneath the radar. And as long as they behave themselves, which they do, it's okay. But the airport was in danger, I think, about 22 years ago of being leveled, sold and leveled. And kind of at the 11th hour, an arrangement was made to have some guys that had businesses there purchase the airport. And they bought the airport, and a few days later, they all got together for a meeting. And they're kind of, okay, we own an airport. What are we doing with it? And it took them a couple of years to really come to grips with what they needed to do with it. But one of the guys had a business there where early on, I think it was the bailiff in Riverside County Court over there, came calling and said, we have people that need to work off small crimes. Would you be willing to take people and put them to work out here? And he said, sure. So they started bringing people, and these weren't dangerous people or anything. And after a few weeks, this guy, who's one of the best people I've ever known in my entire life, John Goldenbaum, he was looking at him and saying, they're not any different than when they came in. We're shoving them back once they've done their time. We're shoving them back in.
Right back into whatever they were doing.
Any corrective measures whatsoever. So he talked to the bailiff and said, can we actually show them how to do a job? And the bailiff said, sure, give it a shot. So John had been in a squadron of combat in Vietnam flying Douglas Sky Raiders, and they protected the helicopters that were going out to pick up downed pilots. Very dangerous thing. John said that the good squadrons, which he was a member of this good squadron, Their number one thing is every pilot did not want to let down the rest of the squadron. They were willing to die for the rest of the squadron. They had a job to do. They did the job. They didn't let anybody down. And he said that some of the young people they were getting in were from gangs. And he was talking to them a lot. And he started realizing it's the same attitude. If you're in a gang and you don't know any better, that's how you grew up, you're in a gang, your number one thing is you don't let down the gang. You're willing to die for the gang. And within the gang, you need to do your job, you know, even if it's sticking up a 7-Eleven or something, and not disappoint the rest of the gang.
Yeah.
And once he realized that, he started operating with these young guys the same way and started having some pretty good success. They, one of the first things, and they still do it, they have a day every month, usually a Saturday, that kids can show up with a parent. The parent signs the paperwork, the releases. The kid gets to go up in an airplane for free. A lot of these kids have never touched an airplane before, and here they are, they're getting to fly an airplane, fly in an airplane.
Right.
And a lot of times, if the adult pilot flying the kids thinks this kid, it won't scare him too much or anything, he has them put their little hands around the yoke and talks them through actually flying the airplane. Once they land back at Flaybob, about half the kids hasn't changed them at all. The other half, their horizons have suddenly really broadened. And one key thing that John learned and started implementing it, with these kids that are excited about the whole thing and want to go on, you have to have somebody to tell them what the next step and the next step and the next step is to get to the goal of being able to actually do this. So they are shown every step along the way. Whatever they want to do in aviation, they're shown how to get there. And they all realize pretty quickly that the number one thing is, in school, get good grades. Show up and get good grades. There's been some huge success stories. There's two young guys, I won't use their names, they came from gangs. Both of them had felony youth records. You know, they were
problems.
They were, yeah. That's all they knew. That's how they grew up. As soon as they got into this, they started realizing that, well, if we're going to do this, we've got to change our ways. So they did. They went back to school. They started getting good grades. And they stuck with it. They eventually got their pilot's licenses.
Wow.
But they learned how to work on the airplanes. And they learned how well enough that they went to work for a guy who had a business there restoring antique airplanes. And they got really good. And the guy they were working for decided to move to Tennessee and set up shop there. Left them, and they were up to it. They started on their own getting clients and working on airplanes and everything. And now they have a waiting list of people that want their antiques and classic airplanes restored.
Wow.
And
what a great story.
Sometimes if you could just take them by the shoulder and point them in different directions.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was about 5 or 6 years ago. Do you guys know what a Beechcraft Stagger Wing is?
I do not.
It was the first airplane that Walter Beech made on his own, you know, with his own company, Beechcraft.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-30s. It's a biplane. It looks Art Deco. I mean, it's a beautiful airplane. A very complicated, small airplane. But when Beechcraft came out with the number 17 Stagger Wing, it was faster than any of the military airplanes. And right off the bat, two ladies, Blanche Noyes and Louise Thaden, entered one of those in the Bendix race against all the big guys. And they won the race.
Oh, man.
It was that good of an airplane.
Wow.
That they had no trouble beating the guys.
Wow.
That's great.
Yeah. So these two young kids at Flaybob took on a project of restoring one that had been built for the Royal Navy in World War II. They did all the research, found out exactly the colors it would have been, how it would have been marked with the British roundel on it and everything, stripped it down to absolutely nothing, took the whole airplane apart, put it back together again, and started flying it, got all the bugs out of it and everything, and then flew it to Oshkosh for the big air show. And entered it in the competition, and it took best light transport, which is huge.
Wow.
And the EAA gave the two of them the Golden or a Silver Wrench Award, meaning the Outstanding Mechanics of the Year. And
these were a couple of former gang members.
Yes, they were.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that's what the Tom Wathen Center is all about. There is a build-a-plane program sanctioned by the EAA where they have a hangar. They go around and find derelict airplanes, which there's a lot of. But you have to go to the trouble of legally gaining title to the airplane. And a lot of times that's not easy, but they do it. They drag the Hulks over to Flay Bob. And in this one hangar, the Red Barn, there's a guy, Dave Almy, who is just excellent with the young people. On Saturday mornings, young people come in and they work on the airplanes. They'll have one that's a year away from being restored, and the other one they're just starting on, or one's halfway, the other one's beginning to fly. And the kids will restore the airplane with adult supervision, licensed supervision, so they're being told exactly what to do. They do it. The adult checks it all out and goes, it's fine. He signs it off. It's his name, you know, certifying that it's good. And then once the airplane starts flying, it, you know, gets airworthy, back in license and everything.
How long's this program been in place?
Everything here was a gradual start from about 20 years ago.
Okay.
So quite a while. But once that particular airplane has a few hours on it and they know that there aren't any bugs, the engine's not going to quit or anything else, it's a good airplane, the kids that built the airplane get to go up in their airplane. That's a life-changing experience.
I bet it is.
That they're flying in this thing that they built.
And they're alive when they land because they built the plane.
That's and right. Usually at that point, they're really eager to, if they haven't gotten their license, to finish up getting their license. Yeah. And one of the more incredible stories, there was a young kid who had gone through all of that and decided he wanted to find his own airplane to buy. He was over in Riverside. He was reading the want ads back when the papers had want ads on Sunday. And there was an Aronca Chief for sale. It was a basket case. It was in somebody's garage. He called him up, and he went over and looked at it. And at that point, he really, really, really wanted it. And the guy wanted a few thousand dollars. It wasn't an insurmountable thing, except that this kid had practically nothing. He went and talked to his dad that night about it and started showing his dad a few photos of it and what he knew about restoring it and everything. The dad's prized possession was his Harley Davidson.
I know where this is going.
The dad went over with him to look at the airplane, and he went home and he sold the Harley and they bought the airplane. And the two of them restored the airplane. It's flying now. And the kid got his license. The kid's gone on with all kinds of things. And the father's getting his license now.
Oh, that's such a great story.
And but Flay Bob is just full of that. And you might be wondering, how did they get the name Flay Bob?
I was wondering that.
Back real early on, there was a guy that started the whole thing that was kind of a happy-go-lucky type guy who sold the whole operation real quickly to two guys named Flavio and Bob. And they needed a name for the airport, and after several versions of things, they settled on Flay Bob. So that's
crazy.
Yeah.
So I've been sitting here this entire episode completely intimidated because I'm staring at a shirt sitting across from me that says President of the United States Air Force One. So
did you get that in the gift shop?
No.
The little bar gift shop. We'll have that on our merch page
next week.
So talk to me about the work that you've done with the Air Force One.
I've actually been involved with the 89th Presidential Airlift Group. They call themselves the PAG, the Presidential Airlift Group, for over 20 years. And do you remember a little incident where about a year and a half after 9/11, maybe 2 years, Air Force One 747 was flown up to New York with two chase planes. One of them had a photographer in it, and they wanted to get some good photos of Air Force One with the Statue of Liberty alongside. Now, they called up the appropriate people in Manhattan to say, we're coming. Don't let it scare you. We're coming. And those people in Manhattan apparently didn't tell anybody.
Oh, my God.
So,
and this here, is after 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Within about 2 years of 9/11. So people in lower Manhattan suddenly see a 747 coming low level with two fighters alongside it. They freak out. All of lower Manhattan freaked out over the whole thing. And they got one pass before all hell broke loose. And they had to turn around and get back to Andrews and weather the storm.
Why would anybody have thought that was a good idea?
I have no idea.
Well, how do you not communicate that? I mean, it's just unbelievable.
About another year and a half later, they still wanted that image, but they knew that they're not going to fly the airplanes up there. They had the photos the photographer took on that one pass where they were simply too far away from everything. And they contacted me and said, is there any way that you could do a painting of our Air Force One, one of the two 747s, real close to the Statue of Liberty? And I said, sure. So I did. And they have that painting. Now, taxpayers didn't pay for that painting. The crews paid for it themselves.
Wow.
That's happened several times. I've never done anything for them where it's been taxpayer money. The crews are really proud about what they're doing, and they're willing to go around and get into each other's pockets until they can pay me. And I give them a really good break on the thing anyway.
What? Where does that painting hang?
At Andrews. It's in... we have been lucky enough to be involved with them through four different presidents, both sides. And they are, the 89th is very, very nonpartisan. You can't get them to talk about anybody. And according to their body language and everything else, they love all the politicians. They fly everybody of note. The two big 747s and then the 757s, which are, they're VC, I don't remember, whatever I would say would be wrong. Those are what fly the president. Some of the smaller things like 737s that they have, they don't. They have a couple of Gulfstreams that will fly the president. But the vice president gets flown and all kinds of stuff, and then the secretary of state, everybody really high up in D.C. flies in these airplanes. Mm. And when Nancy Pelosi was still representing us, she would fly back and forth to the Bay Area every single week, and originally in a Gulfstream and then in a 757. But they're very careful not to give any clue as to who they like or who they don't like or anything like
that. I'm
sure. Now, how many times have you flown on one of those planes?
I haven't flown on any of them. I have been in a lot of them.
Yeah.
Joan and I both have about five or six photos of us standing in the door.
What's it like when you walk in?
It's the interior is like being in a nice Hilton, but it's not any better.
Really?
No, it's not glamorous. It's utilitarian, but on the very nice side of utilitarian. It's not anything better than a good Hilton.
Didn't you ever see the movie Air Force One with Harrison
Ford? I did.
Ford?
For some reason, it seemed more like a penthouse to me.
You bring that up. And I was in one of the two 747s with one of their higher crew members who was showing me everything that I don't normally get to see. And we went down into the belly of the airplane. Oh. There is no escape pod. No.
There's
no,
darn it.
There's spare tires. There's orange cones. There's all of that. There's a lot of spare things.
But there's no
there's
escape pod?
There's no escape pod.
Well, that's in the other plane. Then. Yeah. No.
They're jumping on a tire with a parachute. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's disappointing to hear.
Hollywood.
Oh, darn it. I really like the idea of an escape pod. You have paintings hanging in presidential libraries. Gerald Ford.
Uh-huh. And George H.W. Bush.
And
the Reagan.
So how did that come about?
The Reagan Library happened because I had done the Tuskegee mural at the Palm Springs Air Museum, and along with the Corsair that's landing on the carrier there. And the Reagan Library had just found out that they were getting one of the retired airplanes. And they had no idea what to do with it, so they went around to all the especially aircraft museums in Southern California trying to get an idea of what do we do with this airplane. So they came to the Palm Springs Air Museum, and they saw what I had done. So I wasn't there, but one of the guys who was a really good guy happened to have my business card in his wallet, and he gave it to them. And they contacted me a couple of days later, and like the next day I was in Simi Valley talking to them. And then at that point, it took about 2 years to get the thing put together, get the money. Bob Pond decided to back the whole thing. And he told me he was going to do it. The hamburger place over in Palm Springs, I never get over to Palm Springs, but the one, is it Tyler's?
Tyler's. Yeah. Tyler's, one of the
great burger. Not quite as good as Little Bar, of
well,
course.
We, but yes,
Bob
correct.
And I were both having burgers and fries, and I had previously told him about the whole thing, and this was his decision hamburgers. So we're sitting down with the hamburgers and fries and everything. Now, Stanley, I have decided to back you. He's the one that gave them the money for them to be able to pay me because they didn't have the money. Their Air Force One pavilion was going to cost them $10 million.
Wow.
By the time I entered the picture, it had gone up to $34 million.
So you charged him $24 million.
He was 14 of $24.
I wish.
If you want to buy one of Stan's paintings, come heavy, baby.
One of the more incredible things I've witnessed in my life, the morning that they opened up and had all the dignitaries there. Joan and I were there. And T. Boone Pickens was there.
Oh, man.
Who was good friends of the Reagans. And at some point that morning, he asked them, how much are you in debt on building this place? And, oh, about $24 million. And he wrote out a check for the $24 million, paid it off right on the spot.
I would have said $26
million. Yeah.
Yeah, like, stand up with a little. So if do you have a favorite piece of work, or a better way to ask, or a different way to ask, if there was one piece that would tell me everything I needed to know about Stan Stokes, what would that be?
Well, I have one that a good friend, Jimmy DiMatteo, lives down in Coronado. He was a Top Gun aggressor pilot, and he says he's the worst of all worlds. He's a short Italian fighter pilot. And he admits that there's times when his ego could not come with him through that door. He's a very good guy, though. But he's very proud of what he had done with Top Gun. He's got more aggressor time than anybody else. So he had an idea for a painting. And it took 3 or 4 years of talking over things and him kind of arranging how I could get paid and everything else to do a Top Gun painting. But before that, he had me do a painting that was the Centennial of Naval Aviation. His father was also a naval aviator and flew Hellcats in World War II. So these guys are naval aviators. His dad's still with us, too.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But he kind of micromanaged the painting. It's a very big painting. It's, I think, 36 by 72.
You do a lot of large scale.
Yeah. With this painting, there's like 50 different airplanes in it. It goes all the way from the Curtiss Triad that in 1911 was the first Navy airplane and made its first flight as a Navy airplane down in San Diego.
Really?
Yeah. So that's where Naval Aviation started. It's Mission Bay.
Wow.
And so they wanted a painting showing that, and then the other end, a Super Hornet, and then everything in between. And it was all that everything in between that was kind of like, haw. But
how long did that take you?
I don't even remember. A lot of these big paintings, I have to do small paintings while things are drying along. So it's never, I'm never just working on one painting.
Right. How big is your studio?
Well, we just have the house over in La Quinta with a great room. It's the great room. So, and I have found that so far the biggest I've done was 4 feet by 14 feet.
Whew.
And there's just barely room for the cat to get around the outside of it.
So if there's cat hair in the painting, we know.
We know why.
We know where that came from. but you also have done some very large-scale mural work.
Yeah, but let me. There's a big point on this one that makes it to where. So I really enjoyed doing that. It's a Pensacola now, on display down there at the National Museum of Naval Aviation. Jimmy DiMatteo, along the way, when it was finished, said, I need to have a good image of that, and I need to have you sign a release form so that I'm authorized to sign off on copyright. And he said, okay. I mean, you know. So I kind of got wind along the line that he was doing advisor work for Top Gun Maverick. He was helping them design the set that was the officers' club down there for the movie.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other things. And he actually has a very, very brief, you go, oh, there's Jimmy, on thing. You know, with movies, because I've been involved with several movies, you never know if your thing's getting cut until it's actually out in the theaters. They can cut things at the last minute. You never count on it. You don't tell anybody or anything. But they had a premiere of the movie down on the Midway in San Diego, the Midway Museum. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who happened to be there. I had had several friends, but I had one that was the quickest to get on the phone after seeing it and say, Stan, your painting's the movie.
didn't know until then?
No, not until he called.
Wow.
And it turned out that 44 minutes into the movie, when Maverick comes walking around the corner with Admiral Bates, after having just been chewed out by the other admiral for being Maverick. They come around the corner, and right behind them on the wall is my painting.
Wow.
And for the briefest of second, it probably isn't a full second, it's probably like 3/4 of a second, the painting is almost full screen. And if you blinked, you would miss that, and then it just starts, as they're walking towards you, the focus goes from that to them in about another second and a half, 2 seconds. But for that brief amount of time, it's there.
How exciting must have that been?
And it's the only actual painting in the entire movie.
I'll be watching again tonight.
Yeah, 44 minutes.
My wife and the kids love that movie. We see.
We
default to either watching Jaws or Maverick. and so now, 44 minutes and we're going
to
pause.
I can't wait to
check it out.
Yeah.
I'm like, I know the guy that painted that.
We also have a friend whose call sign is Dragon, who flew in the movie.
Really?
Yeah, she's an F-18 pilot up at Lemoore, and she was one of the pilots that the Navy said, go fly for the movie. And she flew all the scenes with a two-seat Super Hornet that you're seeing. Well, the one is Bob, the backseat guy, the Rio, Bob.
Right.
When you see it, she's up front. The other is the young lady, Phoenix. All the scenes where you see Phoenix or Bob, Dragon is up front flying the airplane. And the scenes that you see of them down low going through the canyons and you can see the shadow coming up at them, that was for real. They actually did that for real.
Where'd they film that?
A whole bunch of different places. Part of it was in the Sierras. There's a pass that's restricted to just military aircraft for them to do that type of thing. And it's nicknamed Star Wars Canyon. There's a highway that goes through there, and there's a couple of viewpoints that if you know to do it, you can park your car, and you can go there, and you can stand there long enough and watch F-18s go by you. And about 2 years ago, some guys were there with their cameras taking pictures, and a Super Hornet came up, and I don't know what happened, but the guy actually hit the hill underneath the viewpoint, and the explosive wreckage of the airplane went flying over the photographers.
Unbelievable pictures, but pretty.
I don't know if they kept taking pictures or not.
Man.
Yeah.
But, you know, so a pretty hazardous thing. But they actually had the actors in the back seats of Super Hornets flying that low through the canyons. I can't imagine the insurance company that was involved.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
But a lot of the stuff, because of Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is a pilot. The Mustang scene at the end where he's flying Penny into the sunset and everything, that's Tom Cruise's Mustang that he flies all the time. The insurance company said, well, you're not doing that for the movie. So even though he flies it all the time and everything else, they wouldn't let him fly it. There's a father and son, well-known pilots over at Chino, the Hintons, Steve Hinton and Steve Hinton Jr., that everybody calls Steve-O. And it was Steve-O flying those scenes, and they digitally put Maverick's face on him. But he said he had to do that role, looking into the sun, 7 or 8 times to get it right. They kept saying, "We'll do it again."
Oh my gosh. He said
for quite a while afterwards, he had spots before his eyes.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, that painting, being in the movie and being down at Pensacola, kind of my favorite movie.
I'm sure.
Painting?
Yeah.
So one of the things I love about...
Go ahead.
One of the things I love about many of your paintings, and you showed me the one with the plane landing on the George H.W. Bush carrier. Uh-huh. You capture, and I know it brings the two genres together, your marine work and your aviation work together, but I love how you capture motion in your paintings.
Yeah.
It's really impressive.
I think having been a pilot myself and having done aerobatics and everything else, you know what an airplane does. You know what it's supposed to be doing. There are some airplanes where I cheat a little bit, because what the airplane would be doing is so bizarre that the average viewer wouldn't believe it.
Like, that can't be real.
No.
Don't do that when I'm in the plane.
So you move about halfway into how it really was, into how people would expect it to be sometimes. Not always, but just sometimes. And so you have to have a feel for that, where the people who really know will go, okay, he's close enough. And then the people that don't know, when they're looking at it, they go, gee. So, but having been a pilot, and when I first got to know Bob Pond, I flew with him in all the airplanes.
Wow.
And
he had an enormous stock of planes. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, but when I first got to know him in 81, here, October of 81, he only had 2.
Oh.
I was with him for the acquisition of everything else.
How many did he ultimately end up with?
Several dozen.
Yeah.
And
a lot of cars, too.
Point, he was over 125. I don't know how much over, but over 125.
I emceed an event that they did at the Pond Estate, and when you went to the estate, there were so many buildings that housed cars.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And they were all painted, so they didn't look like a garage, you know.
Yeah. Well, there was one half of it was all the red Ferraris, and the other half was all the green Aston Martins. And I rode with Bob in a lot of them. I personally drove a handful, but just a handful. Because whenever Bob would let the artist get behind the wheel, it was kind of like, something's going to blow. And I did get to drive a Maserati following him in some parade over in Palm Springs. And I drove the second half of that watching steam coming out from underneath the hood. And you're kind of going, oh, this isn't good. This really isn't good.
At 10 miles an hour.
Yeah. That car didn't like putting along that slowly.
So that car's not made to putt along slowly.
No, that's why they smoke. There's quite a history of aviation in this valley. We were talking before the episode about Jackie Cochran.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about Jackie's.
Okay, well, first off, Jackie Cochran was a self-made person. She grew up in abject poverty in the Florida Panhandle. And everything she did because she had a whole lot of tenacity about her and was an extremely smart person. And so you really got to hand it to her. There's a lot of people that like to dump on her for different things and everything, about being so pushy and everything. She had to be. But by being like that.
Well, if you're a female pilot, you probably had to be a little pushy back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think even today.
Even today,
My cousin was a naval aviator, and she was one of the very first. She flew helicopters, and she was one of the first female combat helicopter pilots.
Yeah.
She retired as a captain.
Well, Jackie got a fascination for aviation real early on. She was a beautician. And she kind of worked her way out of being a beautician into, the first thing was, still as a beautician, but beginning to get into aviation, she went to a party with one of the ladies that she did the hair of and got to sit down next to Floyd Odlum. Now, Floyd Odlum at this point probably doesn't mean anything to anybody,
the name.
But he was quite the industrialist. And He was Consolidated Aircraft, San Diego, a bunch of other things like that. He also had a big share of Paramount Pictures.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. And he didn't know who she was. She really didn't know who he was, but they got a big liking for each other almost immediately. And started off from there. And I think it took her a while to realize just who it was that she was with. But I think it was probably very good for both of them to not realize it right off the bat.
Right.
She went over to Roosevelt Field in Long Island, where Charles Lindbergh
right.
had started his transatlantic flight from. And she took a couple of weeks off from work and got her pilot's license. Kind of that quickly.
I'm going to take 2 weeks off and start flying.
Yeah. It was a little bit simpler, you know, the laws, what you do, how you talk, you know. Air traffic control almost wasn't back then.
It was Bob and telling you.
The airplanes were much simpler, but much, much more dangerous. Very dangerous airplanes. But she loved the whole thing. And she got into air racing and had done a bunch of things to start getting some notoriety. And in 1938, she had managed to buy, actually, Sikorsky Aircraft let her borrow this airplane, which a bigger incarnation of it became the Republic Thunderbolt in World War II. But this was a great airplane back then. And in 1938, she entered the Bendix cross-country race from Glendale Airport to Cleveland for the Cleveland Air Races. And it was a staggered start where everybody had a time start. They would start like 10 minutes apart, half hour apart, whatever it was for that year. And then they would take their time when they landed. It didn't matter how many times they stopped. Most of them only stopped once for fuel. But they would. Somebody at Cleveland would know their start time so they could figure out when they landed where they were placing. And she won the thing. She beat all the guys. She beat Roscoe Turner, all those guys. And
was that a really big deal in the aviation industry back then?
That was the biggest.
Yeah.
That was huge. And at the Air Force Academy, they have her Bendix Trophy. Big, big trophy.
Now, how did it end up at the Air Force Academy?
Because she kind of got her way into the Air Force, kind of. When World War II broke out, she initially, before we were in the war, she was ferrying Lockheed Hudsons over to England. They couldn't fly them out of the U.S. because we were officially neutral. So they would push them across the border into Canada and fly them from Canada over to England.
Oh, that's right. They would literally wheel them over.
Yeah, literally hand push them across. She was doing that on one of her flights. She actually got shot at by the Germans. So she knew what it was like to have somebody try to kill her. As soon as we got into the war, she shifted gears and started lobbying to have women serve somehow. The Army was kind of like, whoa, we don't know about this. But they didn't.
Hang on, little lady.
They also didn't know about Jackie, and she kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and eventually the WASPs, the Women's Army Surface Pilots, were formed, and it was women, 100% women. She was put in charge of the whole thing. The women that signed on were taught how to fly at Avenger Field in Texas, and they wound up doing everything that they could possibly do other than combat, flying the airplanes, so that all the men could go and get into combat. So when they would finish building a Lockheed Lightning, P-38 Lightning at Burbank, a lot of times a woman would show up with her parachute and flight suit, get in it, and fly it east. And a lot of times to Wright-Patterson for the Air Force, Army Air Forces to check it out and assign it where it was going to go and everything. But women were flying all the airplanes, all the war airplanes, all over the United States during World War II. Mm. And there were several of them that were lost. There's one who took off from LAX in a Mustang, because Mustangs were built in Inglewood. And they would fly them out of what we now know as LAX, Mines Field. She took off and went into a marine layer and was never heard from again. Now, Josh What's-His-Face has done a whole thing on going out there and trying to find pieces of Mustang, which nobody else, but it's really deep out there, too. So it was not without hazard when you're flying brand-new airplanes, World War II airplanes. It can be very hazardous because those planes were temperamental when they were flying good.
And they were in a hurry to make them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just shove them out.
Needed
yeah.
as many as they could get.
So, Jackie, after right after the war, F-86s were being built by North America in Southern California. She was able to borrow one from the Canadians. And her, with Chuck Yeager in an Air Force F-86, she became the first woman to break the speed of sound. And she did it just up here in our high desert.
Is that right?
That yeah. is amazing.
And then a few years later, when the F-104 Starfighter came out, she had been doing things with the Air Force, but kind of unofficially. And she asked them for an F-104, and they said, no. So she went over to Lockheed and said, I know you have a demonstrator, a two-seat demonstrator. Can I borrow it? And they said, sure, take it. That, with the help of Lockheed and a few Air Force people up at Edwards, teaching her how to survive an F-104, she became the first woman to fly twice the speed of sound.
That's amazing.
That's yeah. something.
And how did she end up out here?
Cliff Henderson, who was the founder of Palm Desert, mm-hmm. he was also the manager of the Cleveland Air Races. She got to know him really well. Everybody was coming out here and spending time with Cliff and Marion Henderson. And they all loved it, especially when they were coming from somewhere up north or the east and the weather was terrible. And then they come out here and it's like today.
Yeah.
And they go, hey, we're going to move out here. Floyd Odlum, who Jackie was married to, was having health problems. He needed to live in warm climates. So it was kind of natural for them to come here. And they bought a whole bunch of property over in Indio, just off of Monroe, and set up household there, and it became a big country club in around there. I have a couple of photos of Jackie and Amelia Earhart, who they knew each other really well. Yeah. They were buddies. Both sitting on the diving board, dangling their feet above the water at the Cochrane Odlum House over in Indio.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
I have the photos.
So. I bet you do.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So everybody that knew Cliff Henderson was coming here, and a lot of them were going, oh, we need to buy something there.
He was a hell of a salesperson.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
I came here in 1981, and he was still briefly around, but I actually got to know Marion pretty well. And I think the last time I saw her, I was flying back from Denver or something like that, and sat right next to Marion, and we chit-chatted the whole way, and we got here to Palm Springs. Her ride didn't show up. So Joan and I wound up driving her home. You're just thinking, that's a piece of history.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's yeah. the valley right there.
You know, it's remarkable. We're at the end of our time, and I thought we were going to talk about art, because I really wanted to talk to you about the large format work, the murals that you've done,
yeah.
because they're enormous. I mean, that's you do some really big artwork.
Yeah.
And he's done some really cool stuff with classic cars.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
No, we didn't even scratch the surface of the art.
We need another week with Stan.
And then
I didn't realize how much of an aviation historian you were.
Have to be.
Yeah.
And then briefly, one thing. Alan Bean, Apollo 12, fourth person to set foot on the moon. I got to be good friends with him. When he retired from NASA, he became an artist. He was coming out here. He had had the artist's equivalent of painter or artist writer's block. He couldn't get started on the next painting, so he was coming out here. He brought his paints. He painted with me for a weekend, and I got him back painting again. And I just told him to forget all the rules. Just paint. Just paint. Just paint. And but while he's painting, he's there 5 feet away from me painting with an easel set up in our great room in the house in La Quinta, and I kept thinking, that guy's been to
he's
the moon.
Been on the moon. Been to the moon.
Yeah, and he's sitting right there.
Did you engage in that conversation?
Of course we did.
Yeah.
And a whole other thing that we have no time for now, Buzz Aldrin had just punched the lights out of a guy who'd written a book saying we'd never been to the moon.
Yeah, and he was trying to, he was yelling at Buzz. Yeah.
And Alan told me how, yes, we've been to the moon, and this is exactly how you prove it. One thing is all the ham radio operators in the entire world were triangulating off of all their radio stuff, which could show exactly where they were going to the moon, orbiting the moon, on the moon, and coming back. So all the Russians, the Chinese, everybody else were triangulating, and they were going, yeah, they're really there. Yeah. So how you can't fake that.
You can't fake that. Well, and now there, we have images of the moon that have been taken. I mean, you can very clearly see the the stuff we left behind.
They're obviously fake. There's no stars in the background.
And he set up a mirror, a reflective mirror, while they were there, that the observatory above San Mateo bounced a laser off of. And at first it wasn't doing it, and he had to adjust it. And he said just as he was finishing adjusting it, working against the pressurized spacesuits was really difficult. And he's lifting up from adjusting it, and he just kind of murmured to himself, okay, and they shot the laser right almost in his face. And he said, somebody put it there.
Somebody had to.
Yeah. Hey,
you know, now when we fake the next moon landing, it's going to be so much better because the CGI is much better.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. AI will take care of everything.
All you have to do is look at, you know, Star Trek episodes in the 1960s, and, you know, we couldn't have faked it.
Oh, that's the one of the paintings I just did for San Diego and Air and Space Museum was Shatner.
Oh, he was there. There you go.
We got to spend the night with Shatner, and he was wonderful.
All right, so now on the second episode, all right, we're going to talk about Shatner. There's almost always a Star Trek connection in our. So really, Shatner was there, and you painted.
Yeah, and he was the nicest guy. He's 92.
Yeah.
They had me do the painting of him, and put him in the Hall of Fame because he's the oldest person to have been in space by 8 years. He was 90 when he went into space. In Bezos' Blue Origin, mm-hmm. down in Texas. And the lady before that, Wally Funk, she was 82 when she went into space.
And how old was John Glenn when he went back up on the shuttle?
Much younger than that. He was old, but still quite a bit younger.
Yeah.
But Shatner, we had another guy there, 95-year-old, Royce Williams, who was a Korean War pilot. Shatner was so concerned over Royce Williams, who's only 3 years older than him, making certain he had a good place to sit, that he had enough water to drink, wow. that nobody was bothering him. And here it is. Bill, don't worry about it. He spent time with everybody. And then when he gave his acceptance speech, it's one of the best acceptance speeches I've ever heard. And I've now heard 99, because I've done 99 paintings for their Hall of Fame.
How happy are you that we finished up this episode talking about William Shatner?
I knew it was going to be a high-flying episode, but now it's soaring. That is amazing. Stan Stokes, what great stories.
Well,
there you go again, Stan.
This has
been
amazing.
Thank you so much. So appreciate it. And Stan, well, I'm going to give your website so people can go. And you can go to stanstokes.net, and you can see his artwork.
Stan Stokes.
Dot art. It actually changed.
Oh, yeah. Dot art. Stan Stokes. Dot art. Stan, thank you so much for taking time out and joining us on this edition of Big Conversation. It was a big conversation.
It was.
Thank you, Randy. Always a pleasure to have you.
Glad to be here again.
And John McMullen, our producer, thank you, sir.
Thanks for letting me back.
Alan Horowitz, our in-house counsel, is with us once again. Thank you so much. We will be back once again here in the corner booth at Skip Page's Little Bar. You're listening to Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar. Recorded on location at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California, the center of the Coachella Valley universe. This program is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. All episodes are available from BigConversationsLittleBar.com or from most major podcast portals, including Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Music.